My name is Sarah Halburn, and I am a student in the Department of Family and Preventive Medicine at the University of Utah, and I'm also a research analyst at the University of Utah Intermountain Injury Control Research Center. I'd like to acknowledge the co-authors on this paper, Steve Alder, Doug Gray, Han Kim, and Michelle Moskis. And I'm going to present to you, from the Utah Youth Suicide Study, evidence-based suicide risk reduction for juvenile offenders. And I have no financial relationships to disclose. Currently, Utah is ranked, Currently, Utah is ranked the eighth highest in the nation for suicide among adolescents. 90% of adolescents and young adults who die by suicide often suffer from either an untreated, undertreated, or undiagnosed mental illness. Comorbidity of diagnoses is what separates suicide completers from suicide attempters, and that means they have more than one diagnosis, and it's usually a mood disorder such as depression or dysthymia and a substance use disorder. And even though the high rates of mental illness are it's prevalent among suicide completers, there's only 5 to 20% in treatment at the time of death. When you look at patterns among youth suicide decedents, you find a family history of psychopathology. You also find difficult parent-child relationships, so you see conflict in the home, but this isn't a primary risk factor for suicide. It's just something you see among families. And usually when there is no mental illness in the family conflict tends to diminish. So it's not that the mental illness is, or it's not that the family conflict is causing the mental illness. It's that the family conflict is a result of having, of somebody in the home having a mental illness. Protective factors for families in reducing conflict show that since the 70s that there needs to be clear expectations for youth and for acceptable behavior, that it's important to monitor behavior, including reinforcement, and that there needs to be a well-defined role within the family so kids are kids and parents are parents. There isn't a confusion in there. In Utah, suicide is a leading cause of death for males aged 15 to 44, and Utah is demographically similar to the rest of the United States in that the majority of those who die are male and the majority of them use firearms. So the Utah Youth Suicide Study did an initial phase where they wanted to figure out what this group of people looks like. They wanted to know what Utah youth decedents, what are patterns that you see among them. So between 96 and 1999, 151 consecutive youth suicide deaths for those aged 13 to 21 were examined, and the findings were that about 63% of them actually had contact with the juvenile court system before they died. 54% of the 95 subjects that were involved with juvenile court had a referral for substance possession use or abuse, and that 32% of them had one felony referral, which means that the majority of these kids are not career criminals. They are youth that have multiple minor offenses. So they'll have curfew, they'll have truancy, littering. So because referral to the juvenile court was a risk factor for completed suicide, we conducted a mental health screening in the juvenile courts for a one-month period of time in June of 1999. There were 719 youth that came into the courts, and we gave them the youth outcomes questionnaire. And this tool was started at Brigham Young University, and it has been researched for over 30 years. It's been used in multiple languages, and it's psychometrically sound. And what it does is it quantifies psychological distress and dysfunction that's associated with having a mental illness. It's not a diagnostic tool. It doesn't give somebody a diagnosis, and you don't need to have a diagnosis to be given this tool. It's really just to measure how youth are dealing with whatever's happening to them in their lives. So the WIOQ uses established ranges. They have an inpatient, an outpatient, and a community range. And these ranges determine what level of intensity the services need to be provided to them. And the lower the score on the WIOQ, the better their mental health is. So I told you about the ranges. If you have a score less than 46, then it means the youth doesn't really need any intervention. If you have a score 46 to 91, it means that they would probably benefit from an outpatient service. And if they have a score of 92 plus, it means that they might need to be hospitalized for a psychiatric illness. So what we found with this 719 group of individuals is we looked at them versus a community control group of the same amount of individuals. And we found that almost 50% of those in the juvenile court population had scores in the outpatient range. And compared to in the control group, there was a little over 20%. In the inpatient range, there's about 18% of those in the juvenile court system. And then when you look at community controls, you don't see any in the inpatient range. So what we found is that this population offers a substantial window of opportunity to actually intervene with these youth, refer them, and treat them for mental health problems if they're experiencing psychological distress and dysfunction, and that the YOQ is an appropriate instrument to identify these individuals, and that the YOQ is also really great because it's a tool that can be used every 7 days, and it tracks outcomes. So if you're giving somebody an intervention, you can see if they're getting better or worse. And you can, over time, you can tell what's happening with their progress. So for the pilot study, we wanted to look at doing an individualized mental health treatment. And so what we did were our questions where we wanted to know if providing this treatment, if it would improve mental health status as measured by the YOQ, if it would decrease the rates of recidivism, which in this analysis, we looked at it as having any new offenses after enrollment. And then we wanted to know of increased rates of suppression, which is no new offense after enrollment. And then we wanted to know if this intervention would be effective in reducing days in detention centers, days in correction centers, and days in observation and assessment. So between March of 2001 and July of 2004, we used 9 local juvenile court offices. Two of those were intake. One of them was an assessment and diversion office, which is when youth first enter the system, and the others were probation offices. And then our inclusion criteria for this pilot study were that youth had to be males, age 13 to 16, and they needed to have between 2 and 12 juvenile court referrals and a YOQ score of 60. So it's kind of in that middle range. 46 was a cutoff for the outpatient. And then we didn't want them to have so many referrals that they had access already to treatment in the court system, because once youth have like 30, they can be 25 depending on what the offenses are, but once they get up there, they start getting services through the court system. So we wanted this to be more of an earlier intervention type of project. Sorry. So the study design was that we matched on YOQ, number and type of offense, and age. We ended up with 22 in the intervention group and 22 in the comparison group. And both groups received compensation for data collection. So they did a YOQ at enrollment at 3, 6, 9, and 12 months. And then for completing all of those, they got $60 at the end. So the intervention group received rapid access to a psychiatric evaluation and treatment for the youth participant within the context of the family system. They received intensive in-home family services through our Utah Youth Village program. It's a family teaching model program. And they also received case management. So the comparison group received existing juvenile court services, and we didn't want to tell them they couldn't get the same services that the intervention group got by restricting their access. We just didn't provide them with coordinated care as we did for those in the intervention group. So they still had access to all the same services that the other youth did. We just didn't do it for them. So we couldn't say you can't have any mental health treatment. You know, it's not very ethically sound to do that. So we didn't. So we had the majority of those in each group were white. And we had one Hispanic in the intervention group, one African-American in the intervention group, and 4 Hispanics in the comparison group. And this is pretty, this pretty accurately represents the state of Utah, whose majority is white. So we wanted to see at study entry if these two groups look the same. So we looked at their family history of depression, ADHD, use of medication, suicide ideation attempt, suicide completion of anybody in the immediate family, and then physical or sexual abuse. And the groups are almost exactly the same, and it wasn't something that we matched on. We just wanted to see if there was something really different that stood out, but they're pretty similar and the same in a lot of the categories. So to analyze the data, we used Data 9, and for the YOQ, measuring mental health status, we used regression modeling. And for recidivism and suppression, we used McNamara's exact test for paired comparisons. And to analyze days in court placement, we used a Wilcox and sign rank test because the data were skewed. So what this graph shows is that after doing a hierarchical regression, that the important part is that there's an interaction effect. So the longer that somebody's in treatment, the more effective the treatment is. And a 12-point drop in their score, which would be the treatment, the 28.497, this 12 points are considered a reliable change on the YOQ. So if they actually have a decrease of 12 points, it means that their mental health status has improved significantly. So we have an average of 28 point drop for the kids in the intervention group. And their mental health was the most improved at 6 months after enrollment. So they were significantly better mental health-wise than those in the comparison group. Here's a different kind of picture of look of what is happening here. So the intervention group at screening, you can see that about half of them are in the inpatient range, a little more than half in the inpatient and about half in the outpatient range. Comparison group, you have more of them in the outpatient range, but just between the screening and enrollment, you can see that the comparison group actually got a lot better, having no services, and now you have a third in the community range, and you have a third in the inpatient range. And then the enrollment group actually looks a little bit worse. We have more people. They look pretty much similar to what they look like at screening. But so the groups actually changed anyways on their own, which is something just to note. At 6 months, you now have half of the intervention group in the community range, which means they may not need treatment. And you have a very small group of them in the inpatient range. When you look at comparison group, they look very similar to what they look like at enrollment, and I'll go back and show you. Here they are there, and here they are there. Okay, so the comparison group kind of looks the same as throughout the year post-enrollment, with just receiving existing juvenile court services, while those in the intervention group actually are getting better. And here's where I said that they're most improved at 6 months post-enrollment. You can see that in this picture right here. So they're still at 12 months a lot better than they were at screening and enrollment, those that received the intervention. So we looked at recidivism. This is, again, if they had any new offense, and you look at the intervention versus comparison group, you don't see any difference between the two of them. They weren't statistically different. When you look at suppression rates, which is no new offense, the intervention group had significantly fewer, their rates of suppression were significantly higher than those in the comparison group at 6 months, but there wasn't a difference at 12 months. When we look at juvenile court placement in days, you see that at observation and assessment, the comparison group actually had significantly more time spent in that facility. Detention centers were not statistically different. You can see you would think they are because of the numbers, but they're not. And youth corrections, the comparison group spent significantly more time in youth corrections than those in the intervention group. Now, the 58 days that were spent in the intervention group in youth corrections were actually for offenses that were committed before the enrollment because there's a time delay in when somebody is, you know, they offend, and then by the time they get to court and the time they get actually have a consequence, it can be, you know, a few months. So that 58 days was actually for offenses before they were enrolled. So the cost, this wasn't analyzed for difference, but what you can see is that ONA was $17,400. This is just by how much they normally cost per day. Detention, $77,700 for those in the comparison group, compared to $23,300. Youth corrections, $162,000 was spent versus $14,500. The treatment, there was no treatment provided to those in the comparison group, so that's why that's zero, and there was $121,000 spent on those 22 youth in the intervention group. And even given that, they still cost $100,000 less than those who did not receive mental health services. Okay. So what we found was that there were significantly fewer days in corrections in ONA for the intervention group. They had significantly higher rates of suppression in the first 6 months, and they had significant improvement in mental health status as measured by the Youth Outcomes Questionnaire. So these findings suggest that, you know, we want to keep youth in the home, and if they're in observation and assessment, and if they're in corrections, they're not in the home anymore. They're living outside the home, and so you're not really treating some of the problems that occur at the home. And so we feel like mental health screening, referral, and treatment should be provided at an initial involvement before they actually end up in a facility living outside of their home, and that in-home services be provided to youth earlier in the juvenile court process, because as I said before, they have to have 30 or more offenses to even be qualify to have these services considered. So this allows you to remain with their family, and it allows people to go into the home and help the family function better as a whole. So some limitations from our study were that the sample size was small, but even though it was small, we did have significant findings, and that it was limited to males only. So what we did is we received a grant from the Garrett Lee Smith Memorial Act through SAMHSA. And it was a 3-year grant to expand these services to all youth involved in the juvenile court system, and to expand mental health services to those who need them, and to implement an ongoing evaluation. The findings were remarkable for the pilot study, but you know, that's only 22 kids, and we want to know what's going to happen when you actually give it to everybody and you track those youth over time. So that's what we're doing now, and we want to be able to measure the effectiveness of this program as it grows. And there's my contact information if you have any questions.